The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues for the next half hour. I'll be reading articles initially from the Harvard Health Letter. This is the Harvard Health Letter of October 2024. And the first is a very relevant article, which is entitled "The Surprising Side Effect of Eye Surgery. Incisions and resulting inflammation might cause dry eye disease or worsen an existing case. Here is what to do if you need a procedure." Modern surgery can do wonders for eye problems. It can correct your vision, remove cataracts, slow glaucoma, or fix droopy eyelids. But after eye-related surgery, many people discover an unpleasant new problem, a burning, gritty, or even itchy feeling in the eyes known as dry eye disease. Dry eye disease involves a loss of balance in the tear film, the layer of oils, mucus, and water on the surface of the eye. The tear film has many important functions, like protecting your eyes from bacteria and irritants, helping your eyelids glide over your eyes smoothly and without irritation, and focusing light for clear vision. If there is a change in the way tear film ingredients are produced, maintained, or drained off the surface of the eye, you can develop dry eye or experience worse symptoms if dry eye disease already exists, says Dr. Nandini Venkateswaran, a corneal and cataract surgeon at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts Eye and Ear. Common causes of dry eye disease include aging, chronic exposure to a dusty environment, medication side effects, underlying conditions, wearing contact lenses, and a habit of not blinking enough, something most of us do when we stare at electronic screens. Any type of eye-related surgery can also trigger dry eyes. Surgery can disrupt the delicate balance of the tear film in a number of ways. For example, in surgery to replace a cloudy eye lens, a cataract, the surgeon makes incisions on the surface of the eye, which can irritate nerves and cause inflammation that affect how the tear film and eyelid interact. Also, the many eye drops that are used before, during, and after eye-related surgery can promote dry eyes. Some eye drops have preservatives in them, which can contribute to inflammation on the surface of the eye. And any factor that increases inflammation on the eye surface can lead to signs and symptoms of dry eye disease, Dr. Venkateswaran says. Dry eye disease is even more likely to occur after surgery if you have an existing eye condition like glaucoma, if you've been using eye drops with preservatives for a long time, or if you've had eye surgery in the past. But for the majority of people, Dr. Venkateswaran sees, the main culprit is simply undiagnosed problems with the tear film. In many cases, people have had dry eye disease for a long time and didn't know it. Some evidence suggests that up to 80% of people have dry eye when they come to the office interested in cataract surgery. There's no way to know if dry eye after eye-related surgery will be temporary or permanent, especially if you already had tear film problems before the procedure. Dr. Venkateswaran advises that you go into any eye surgery expecting a degree of eye dryness afterwards, and that you work with your doctor for treatments. Expect a stepwise approach that ranges from over-the-counter treatments to prescription therapeutics based on the severity of your dry eye. Over-the-counter remedies include preservative-free artificial tears, eye gels or ointments used at night, and warm compresses or heated eye masks, which encourage the production of oils that help reduce friction when you blink and help keep the tear film from evaporating. If those conservative approaches don't relieve dry eye discomfort, doctors can offer other treatments. Some eye drops reduce inflammation. Examples include cyclosporin, and the names of these eye drops are Restasis, or Sequa, or Vivi, Then there's lefitograst or Xiidra, and topical steroids. Other eye drops like perfluorohexyloctane or MIBO help stop tears from evaporating. Nasal sprays like varenicline or Tirava are used to stimulate tear production. Your doctor can insert punctal plugs in the openings of the tear ducts to help retain tears on the eye surface. Delicate equipment used to gently warm the eyelid can be prescribed. Treatments like LipiFlow or Tear Care, which promote oil production from the eyelids. Then there's blood-based eye drops. This treatment is derived from platelets or serum from your own blood. These blood components contain vitamins, proteins, or growth factors that might reduce surface eye inflammation. Then there's amniotic membranes. In an office procedure, a doctor applies amniotic membranes extracted from placental tissue. These membranes are placed on the surface of the eye, dissolve over time, and help to reduce inflammation, Dr. Venkateswaran says. Keep in mind that not all these treatments are covered by insurance. Some can cost hundreds of dollars out of pocket. And that it may take time to find the remedy that works best for you. Before you have any eye-related surgery, weigh the benefits of the procedure with the risks of developing dry eye or making an existing case even worse. Ask your doctor to help you decide which is the bigger problem, dry eye or cataracts. For example, if you have more symptoms from dry eye than from cataracts, establish a regimen that controls your dry eye disease before surgery, so the disease remains well controlled afterwards, Dr. Venkateswaran says. And remember that you need to invest time and effort into controlling dry eye. If you're willing to put in the work, you'll have less discomfort and better vision quality. Now here's another very useful article. It is from the Harvard Health Letter, and it's called Ask the Doctor. And the question is, my doctor says I should get vaccines for flu and COVID, but I've never had either flu or COVID, so why do I need a vaccine? Most people are not as lucky as you, says Dr. Anthony Komaroff, the editor-in-chief. In their lifetime, many people get sick from influenza multiple times, and blood tests show that most people in the United States have been infected with the COVID virus, even though some people may not have realized it. Each of these viruses can make a person very sick. In the United States, 15 to 50,000 people die from the flu every year, and over a million have died from COVID. Fortunately, there's no doubt the vaccines for each virus are effective in reducing the risk of getting very sick. You may know all this and still wonder if you really can benefit from these vaccines. So here's something else to consider, as shown by several important recent studies. The flu and COVID viruses both can injure the body, making it vulnerable to developing new major illnesses. Take the flu. A study involving 26,000 people published in the medical journal New England Journal of Medicine Evidence in July 2024 found that in the week following the flu, the inflammation caused by the flu virus destabilized plaques of atherosclerosis, causing clots to form. As a result, people were six times more likely to have a heart attack in the first week after getting the flu than these same people had been in the year before they got the flu and in the year after they recovered from it. Many of those people had not previously been diagnosed with heart disease. Another new study compared 135,000 people who developed COVID to 5.2 million who did not, but were similar in age, gender, and medical conditions. The individuals were identified in 2020 before the COVID vaccine was available. Scientists found that those who got COVID had a much higher risk for heart, lung, gastrointestinal, and brain disease over the next 3 years, including more heart attacks, strokes, and newly developed Alzheimer's disease. This was true even of people who had been only mildly ill with COVID. The evidence was published in the journal Nature Medicine in June 2024. Finally, an outstanding study involving 6 million people in the United States found that getting the COVID vaccine greatly reduces the risk of these diseases. The findings were published in the New England Journal of Medicine, July 2024. So even if you are one of those unusual people who've never gotten the flu or COVID, or at least haven't gotten sick from them, there are still good reasons to get the vaccines. Not only did they reduce your risk of getting the flu and COVID, they also reduce your risk of getting severe, serious additional diseases. Who would not want that? Now here's another useful article in the October 2024 issue of the Harvard Health Letter. And it's entitled, Get Your Hiking Muscles in Shape. Tone your leg and abdominal muscles before heading out on the trail. Trekking through nature is exhilarating and also gives your heart, lungs, and muscles a workout. Autumn's cooler temperatures make the outdoor activity especially inviting. Just make sure you prepare your muscles for the journey, especially if it's been a while since you've hiked on uneven terrain. You don't want to overdo it in the great outdoors and come back sore and sorry that you did. Hiking relies on many muscle groups and is especially taxing for the muscles in your legs and core, which includes the abdominal, pelvic, and back muscles. Often when you're hiking, you have a prolonged uphill climb and a steady downhill descent. Going uphill, the workhorses that propel you forward are the calf muscles, the hamstrings in the back of the thighs, and the gluteal muscles in the buttocks. The core muscles provide stability. You rely on the same muscles going downhill, but you also need the quadriceps in front of the thighs, which help to act as brakes, says Dr. Sarah Eby, a sports medicine physician at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts General Hospital. The challenges of hiking, not just going up and down hills, but also navigating uneven terrain strewn with rocks or fallen branches, are fraught with risk. The most common injuries we see are twisted ankles or arm injuries from slipping and reaching out to break the fall, Dr. Eby says. Tendon injuries are also common. People often have weak gluteal muscles in the buttocks from too much sitting. Then they go for a hike and the muscles suffer from overuse. You can get tendon injuries where the muscles attach on the outside of the hip. We also see injuries in the Achilles tendon, which connects the calf muscle to the heel. It takes muscle strength as well as good balance, endurance, and cardiovascular fitness to go hiking. Not sure you're up to it? Check with your doctor, especially if you haven't exercised for a while. It's best to start out with daily hiking on a level ground. Stretch your muscles afterward. Eventually add 2 sessions per week of muscle strengthening. Gradually increase the amount of time you walk and the amount of weight you lift. Place extra emphasis on your hiking muscles. You don't need to do anything fancy, Dr. Eby says. The go-to exercise for hiking work all of your leg, buttock, and core muscles at once, such as stair climbing, lunges, squats, or sit-to-stands. If you plan to use trekking poles, which help improve stability and take some stress off your legs, Dr. Eby recommends that you also spend time strengthening your shoulders with exercises like planks, which also work your core muscles. Be sure to practice walking with the poles so you're comfortable using them. Once you're ready to hike, Dr. Eby suggests starting on a trail that's rated easy, with fairly level, less rocky terrain. She also recommends hiking for a much shorter distance than you're used to walking. If you've been walking 2 miles around your neighborhood, choose a hike that's 1 mile, because walking on uneven terrain will be more intense. You don't want to end up exhausted, Dr. Eby says. If you enjoy your first few hikes, slowly increase the distance and difficulty of subsequent treks. In between hikes, steadily increase the intensity and duration of your workouts. It takes time and training to hike on more advanced trails, Dr. Eby says. Be safe and take your time reaching your goals. For additional information about strength training, check out Harvard Special Health Report, Strength and Power Training for All Ages, at www.health.harvard.edu/SPA, S-P-A. And it points out that what they mean by the sit to stand is you first sit in a chair with your hands crossed on your chest or held out in front of you at chest level. Your feet should be flat on the floor, hips hip width apart, and directly beneath your knees. Lean forward and slowly stand up. Hold, slowly sit down, and repeat this 10 times. There seem to be a lot of useful articles in the Harvard Health letter this time. And one of these is, should you try tools to clean your ears? Inexpensive gadgets to remove earwax might cause more problems than you bargained for. Let's face it, some of us have a hard time getting rid of earwax. Buildup of the sticky substance can lead to pain, ringing in the ears, and even hearing loss. And home remedies to remove blockages are messy and might take a few applications. That could explain the growing popularity of earwax removal gadgets for home use. The trend is concerning to audiologists. I see why people would think this is easy and it saves them visits to the doctor, but I don't recommend using these tools. When you put something in your ear like that, you're most likely going to make an ear problem worse, says Megan Reed, Director of Clinical Audiology at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts Eye and Ear. Why clean the ears? You don't normally have to do anything to keep the inside of your ears clean. They have their own ingenious system. The body secretes an oily, waxy substance called earwax that removes dust, dirt, dead skin cells, and other debris as it slowly seeps out of the ear. But as we age, earwax can get drier, harder, or stickier, leading to unpleasant earwax buildup. You might be more prone to buildup if you wear hearing aids or wear earbuds for a long period. Any item worn in your ear can keep earwax from exiting naturally. You might initially notice an earwax blockage as a sensation your ear is clogged or plugged. The longer you wait to do something about it, the more uncomfortable it can become. Earwax removal devices are readily available online and in drugstores. They mimic the instruments the ear specialists use. One popular tool is a long, thin instrument with a tiny camera on the end. It's inserted into the ear to provide a better look at earwax. The image is sent to your smartphone. The tool comes with attachments, various sizes of little spoons or scoopers, to help you to loosen and remove the earwax blockages. Another type of tool is an ear canal vacuum. The small handheld vacuum, about the size of a slim TV remote, has a skinny tube that's inserted into the ear for drainage. It might also come with tools for digging and scooping out earwax. At a cost of $15 to $50, these tools won't break the bank, but there is a risk they'll break the fragile parts of your ear. People aren't trained to use these tools and judge the distance and curves of the ear canal, especially on themselves. As a result, they frequently come to see us with scratched and bleeding ear canals or perforated eardrums. Now we're talking about potentially long-lasting damage that causes more trauma than any earwax blockage would. Getting rid of a small blockage can be a do-it-yourself job, but not with tools you stick in your ear. The safest tried-and-true method involves only a few drops of a store-bought earwax lubricant, water or hydrogen peroxide. You can place a little water or hydrogen peroxide in an aspirator or on a cotton ball to help you dribble it into your ear. Tilt your head away from the affected ear. Let the drops fall gently into the ear canal. Wait a minute, then lift your head back up to drain the dissolved wax. To cut down a mess, drain your ear into a washcloth. You might need to go through this procedure once a day for a few days. But it's cheap, it usually works, and it doesn't involve sticking a hard object into a delicate organ. If the home remedy doesn't work, it could be that you have a large blockage or you have chronic earwax buildup problem, in which case a home remedy might be ineffective. If so, it's time to see your primary care provider, an audiologist, or an otolaryngologist, which is an ear, nose, and throat doctor. The provider will use the right tools with a light or microscope for a good view of the ear canal and effective removal. If there is damage, like irritation or bleeding, the doctor can apply medication. The provider might also recommend earwax drops to help prevent buildup and give you guidance about how often you should come in for earwax removal. Now, once again, from the Harvard Health Letter of October 2024, 4 steps to battle early signs of brittle bones. If protecting your bones isn't already a top priority, a diagnosis of osteopenia will change that. Osteopenia is an indication that your bone density is decreasing and that you're at increased risk for osteoporosis, a disease of thin, weak bones that can break easily and often. Osteopenia can progress slowly or rapidly to osteoporosis depending on your health. This realization brings the potential for fractures, disability, and a loss of independence into sharp focus. What can you do to avoid the risks? First, you can talk to your doctor about medication. Medications that slow bone loss and reduce fracture risk aren't necessarily the first line of defense against osteopenia. These drugs, like alendronate or Fosamax, ibandronate and resendronate, Actonel, are typically reserved for people with osteopenia and a previous spine or hip fracture, or with osteopenia and a high risk for fracture in the next 10 years, as calculated with a bone density test and a fracture risk assessment called a FRAX score. But what if you don't fit into one of these categories? If you have osteopenia and you're likely to lose bone density over time, one could argue that it makes more sense to take the medication and maintain bone density now rather than try to regain it later, says Dr. Harold Rosen, an endocrinologist and director of the Osteoporosis Prevention and Treatment Center at Harvard-affiliated Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. He suggests having a frank discussion with your doctor about the pros and cons of treating osteopenia with medication, including the rare risk of an atypical thigh bone fracture and bone loss in the jaw, the need to take a drug holiday every 5 years. Also, there's exercise. Bones become stronger when we put force on them and pull on them by using our muscles. Weight-bearing exercise like resistance or strength training or body weight exercise is an effective way to do this. But Dr. Rosen says we also need aerobic balance and posture exercise to fight osteoporosis. We have good evidence that simply walking at a brisk pace reduces the likelihood of osteoporosis. You also need to improve your balance so you'll reduce your tendency to fall, and improve your posture to reduce the risk that you'll develop severe curvature of the upper back. Superman stretches are great for posture. You lie on your stomach for a few seconds at a time with your head up and your arms and legs stretched out like you're flying, Dr. Rosen says. You should also get the right nutrients. Bones rely on calcium to get stronger, and your body needs vitamin D to absorb calcium. Dr. Rosen recommends taking a vitamin D3 supplement of 1,500 to 2,000 international units per day, and getting 1,000 milligrams per day of calcium. Try to get as much calcium as you can from food like dairy products, sardines, and leafy greens. If you're not getting enough calcium in your diet, Dr. Rosen recommends taking a low-dose calcium citrate supplement to make up the gap. You should also consume plenty of protein, which helps to build strong bones. Good sources include poultry, fish, legumes, and dairy products. Limit alcohol content intake to no more than one drink per day, since alcohol can interfere with bone health. One add-on treatment for low bone density is vibration therapy, which involves standing on a small vibrating platform or pad. The idea is to fool the bones into thinking they're being stressed, so they build up accordingly. You'll find large vibration pads in clinics, or you can purchase a home version, but it's unclear if the vibrations make it up past your knees. An approach still under development involves wearing a vibration device as a belt closer to the hips and lower spine. Dr. Rosen is involved as a consultant for this product, which is not yet available. But he says we don't have enough proof yet that any type of vibration therapy improves bone strength or reduces fracture risk. Bone loss speeds up significantly after age 60, and if you don't do anything about it, the loss will continue. But taking the steps we've laid out might help build bone and stave off osteoporosis. It's a battle we all have to fight as we age, and one that needs to be at the top of the daily to-do list. And in an attached picture, it emphasizes that weight-bearing exercise, like strength training, helps bones become stronger. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.